Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm speaking with Mark Labberton. He is president of Fuller Theological Seminary. He's a pastor, teacher, and author of a number of books, including one titled Called, which we're going to talk with him about today, The Crisis and Promise of Following Jesus Today. Welcome to Life Quest.
Thank you very much.
Why did you write this book at this time?
Well, I think what stirred me really was the fact that as I look around the landscape at the skepticism of the culture toward the church, as well as the erosion within the church, it seems to me that there's really a crisis at hand. It's represented by symptoms of complaint and cynicism and despair and arguments and all that. But I think what it's really about is that fundamentally the church shows lots of signs of having forgotten its identity and having failed to practice who we really are, and then believing that we live in some place that we don't. And those three things together, I think, cumulatively create a really quite significant crisis, actually. And the symptoms then seem actually minor by comparison to the deeper concerns that are, I think, underlying some of what we're seeing.
Well, in your first chapter, which you've titled Called to Flourish, what do you mean by that? The church or personally? Unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, I use the word flourish to capture what I think the Bible means by shalom, really a sense of well-being in every direction that is part of God's desire, individual, corporate, public, private. Now, that shalom, of course, is by no means ordinary human experience. We live in the peace that comes in Jesus Christ, but we also live in a world that is in the process still of coming to live into that peace that the gospel has come to make possible. And so I think what I'm referring to there is that we need to understand that God really wants us to flourish. I don't think call is first and foremost about something we're supposed to do. I think it's really first and foremost about who we're supposed to be, namely that we are meant to be people made in the image of God who find our way back to our true identity in Christ and then live that in the world. That is the core of what establishes the possibility of full human flourishing.
And you just used that term I was going to ask you about next, and that is you're suggesting that we all need to hear a call. Now, people talk about being called into the medical profession or called to be a pastor or some other career. How do you mean it here?
Well, I mean it in both senses, but I think I start with trying to say that the primary call that I think is on that God offers to anyone who is willing to follow Jesus Christ is a call first and foremost to live as someone who is beloved by God in the context of communion with God in Christ and seeking to be a daily, ordinary follower of Jesus in every circumstance and dimension of life. Then I think the extension of that is that it naturally awakens in us a desire to think about how we use our time, our work time, our play time, our family time, our civic time, to be able to demonstrate perhaps a more specified or focused sense of call. But whatever we're doing and wherever we are, we live the primary call, which is to belong to Christ and to live as though that's true.
Often in Christianity, Pastor, we look upon our Christian faith as something we accept, a subject, something we do on weekends. And yet when I talk to people of other religions, of other faith, you know, are you a Muslim? Are you a Hindu or a Buddhist? Yes, I am. But if I say that to a Christian, it's, well, I'm trying to be. Is this tied in something about what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's an interesting difference. I've run into the same thing. I guess the first thing that occurs to me from that is that I think Christians, to some degree, live with a kind of vulnerability. We say that we believe in grace, but I'm not sure that we actually do trust and live in grace. Mm-hmm. We affirm it as a theological proposition, but I think we still wonder whether, in fact, God really is a judge who's going to somehow find us out, and therefore, in the end, it's all going to turn out rather badly.
Yeah.
I think it's an example of what I remember one time talking to a friend of mine who was in a church that I would just call an especially vibrant, alive church. And I said, what do you think is the difference between your church and other churches? And he said, well, I think in our church, we actually really believe the gospel. And I thought, well, maybe it really is as core as that. It really is the case that they were a church that practiced and lived in grace. And I think I can certainly say I've attended churches, I've been around churches, I've bumped into contact with churches that I wouldn't say permeate themselves with a sense of the grace of Christ.
As I've started into your book and reading it and reviewing it, I come to chapter 2, and you've titled it A Lost Church in a Lost World. Now, we talk about lost people in church, and we talk about a lost world. Haven't heard many people talk about lost churches.
Right. Well, I think that's part of the crisis. This is why I've written the book. I do think that churches are lost, congregations are lost, and denominations are sometimes lost, individual personal disciples can be lost. I think it's what I'm trying to refer to is just that we can participate in what I, with some tongue-in-cheek, but not a lot of tongue-in-cheek, referred to as the ecclesiastical industrial complex. We can be deeply embedded sometimes even in the industry that we call church, all of its activities, its buildings, its programs. But in the end, we really are no more found in Christ than many who are not around the church. And I think that shows up in the failure to integrate our faith into our real life. We have church life, and then it's often segmented off from the rest of life. Or we have church life that affirms the gospel, but we can't really let it sink all the way into the core where we can live out of being beloved. But instead, we still are desperately anxious to make our identity, to gain our possessions, to have our control, to exercise our power, to demonstrate our skills. And it's not really done in freedom or grace. It's really done still out of an act of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
I think we also see it, frankly, in the absence of our faith moving us into sacrificial acts of love toward our neighbor, and even, as Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, even toward our enemies. Those are meant to be, I think, somewhat ordinary fruit. But in fact, the church is, you know, often stereotyped as a church that kills its own wounded, and
yeah,
a church that can often be very tragically and sadly as injurious toward each other or toward its neighbor as to do anything that would really be called the grace of God or the love of God toward our neighbor. So I think those are signs to me that something's really deeply wrong, not just kind of superficially wrong. And it's not about, in my view, the culture wars. It's really about us as God's people forgetting to live into our identity.
And in this chapter, you have several sections here about a variety of churches, if I can mention them to our listeners: the self-absorbed church, or the invisible church, the oppressive church, maybe that's what you just referred to, or even the bad news versus the good news church. But would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I just think part of what I'm trying to get at there with that kind of typography is just that in a variety of ways, it seems to me that we sort of reveal who we really are. And it doesn't take long being around a church before we begin to get a sense that who we are or claim to be is not really how we actually live. So we might claim, of course, to be a church that's centered in Christ, but anybody that would be around a given church often can fairly quickly smell that it's a place of hostility or a place of emptiness or a place where it's about form but very little about life, or it's a place that makes a lot about doctrine but very little about action. It's a place that seems to be mostly absorbed with making sure that we're the best, the biggest, the brightest, the latest, the coolest, the hippest church. But that may or may not really actually be very much like the fruit of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the disconnection. So those labels are just meant to try to tag into a variety of different ways that I think we can lose our way. And I don't think it's hard to find examples of that.
Many times, some of us, when things don't go right, whether it's health or finances or our kids, and we're believers, and yet we immediately begin to say, well, what have I done wrong? Or what can I promise God to make it go right?
I think that would be an example of an unintegrated life. It's almost like an example to me, that sort of thinking is understandable. We believe in a God of goodness and grace, and if bad things happen to us, we are suspicious that maybe God has abandoned us.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, that way of thinking tends to be far more common in the Western world than it is in a lot of the global South or the majority, so-called majority world, where there's a whole lot more actual deprivation and suffering than often is experienced in Western culture. And it's partly because we have correlated really the expectation that if God is God, then we should really pretty much just have a life of blessing. It's really an expectation of what I call promised land living. We really expect to be living in a promised land, and in the promised land, bad things don't happen. So if we think we're in the promised land and bad things happen, then it must be because God has failed us. This, of course, was exactly what Israel believed when they got into the promised land, and it was a whole lot more complicated than they thought it was going to be. And likewise, God says, yeah, it's a lot more complicated, and you're a lot less faithful than I intended you to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a kind of twisted theology that we really need to give up. We live now, I think, the church in the Western world really basically lives in exile. We live as a peculiar people in a context where the structures and cultural assumptions of Christendom are just no longer pervasive in the way that they once were. I think that's good in many ways because it highlights for us, we ask the question, are we really a believer because of some benefit, namely a sense that we get to live in a promised land, or are we believers really because we're seeking to follow the God who is the one true and living God? And those are quite different things. And if we think we're living in promised land and we're disappointed, then we get angry at God or reject God. If we understand that we live actually in exile, we begin to count our blessings, I think, in a very, very different way.
Well, I was just going to ask you about this term exile. Sometimes a lot of people shop from church to church. They look for the right church that has the most truth or something like that. And yet, even so, you're suggesting that we sometimes within a particular belief system or North America or wherever, there's a benefit to this concept of exile.
Absolutely. I think there's a huge benefit. I mean, the benefit, you know, when Israel suddenly is sent into exile under Babylonian rule, it's done, as we see it in the Old Testament, it's done as an exercise of spiritual discipline. God's really saying to Israel, now I'm going to strip you of the temple and the rituals and patterns of your life that reassure you that I'm your God, because you haven't lived consistently with me anyway. And now stripping that away, I'm going to ask you, now in this context, with all of that gone, who do you really trust? Is it yourselves or is it really me? And that, I think, is meant to be, in the deepest sense, a genuine pathway of blessing, of acknowledging that we don't simply turn to our culture or our checkbook or our job or an easy cultural setting, but actually we turn to God, who alone is the source of our life and our freedom and our joy and our hope. Now, it's harder, of course, to live in exile than it is to live in the promised land. But I think the argument of the Old Testament, and I think Jesus is saying pretty much the same thing, especially, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount, that real blessing comes from understanding that we're called to a very different kind of life that will be angular to the culture that's around us.
I have a project going on where I'm interviewing Christians about their journey of faith and how did they come to be where they are today in their journey. And many grew up in a particular a church or in a Christian home, and yet at some point they had to make a decision for themselves that this wasn't just something they inherited, but they had to make a choice. That's the way it is for a lot of us in the Western world of Christianity.
That's right. That's right. Well, I grew up outside the life of the church and didn't come to faith in Christ until I was entering college. And I was at a secular, small, liberal arts college. And
and
I was very, very aware that to make this decision to follow Christ was deeply counterintuitive to me and counterintuitive to the world that I had been a part of or the world that I had every intention of being a part of. And so I think one of the reasons why some of this feels so palpable to me is that with that background, I think I see it somewhat differently than people that have grown up with a lot of Christian assumptions around them. That wasn't mm-hmm. my context. And then as a pastor for the majority of my adult life in Berkeley, California, very much an exotic place for Christians, it's a context which puts this vividly in front of me. But, of course, that culture is quietly present all around us. It doesn't have to be Berkeley, California, where you see that.
Mm-hmm. In Chapter 5, which you've titled Reorienting, there's one section about God's call. Do we believe it or do we live it? And you start that section with a story about being at a wedding rehearsal dinner. Can you share that with our audience?
Yeah, I was at this wedding rehearsal, and the next day I was going to be performing the wedding. It was not a context in which I knew many of the people that were attending the wedding. So mm-hmm. I was just standing around waiting before the wedding began and before the rehearsal began. And friends that were going to come to the rehearsal dinner were there, and there was this one couple that I began to chat with. They were just friendly people. We started talking. They started really with kind of an unguarded candor, just expressing what they were interested in, what substances they abused, what they kind of had a very sexualized way of presenting themselves as mm-hmm. well. And then they eventually said to me, and what do you do? So I thought, well, this will be a conversation stopper.
Yes.
So I told them what I did. I just said, well, actually, I'm a pastor, and tomorrow I'm going to perform this wedding. And on a dime, the woman in this couple said, oh, you know what? We have Jesus, too, and that's all that really matters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it felt to me like it was one of those little moments where it was like they were conjuring Jesus as though he was a hologram. And really, it didn't really matter at all how they lived or how they integrated their faith into their life. It was just that they had sort of an insurance card called Jesus that they could pull up when such a moment arrived and hope to pull up eventually in eternity. But it had no impact on the way that they were actually living, or so it seemed. So that was just one of those moments where I thought, you know, this is the implication of a lot of teaching on grace that just says all you really need to do is just confess Jesus. Well, that's true, but that's the beginning. It's not the destination. And I think that's where a lot of the misunderstandings of grace arise and where the problems really do emerge. A tendency to feel like as long as I have my personal salvation, everything is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to do anything about that. I just need to say, Jesus, I trust you, as opposed to I trust you and want to follow you, and I will never do that fully and completely, but I will give you my life and seek to do what I can to be a faithful follower. That's a really, really different way, not just of believing, but doing.
We're back to, again, this business of how does my daily life, how is it impacted by what
right.
I claim to believe?
That's right.
And this happens, you're saying, even to people who may be in church every week.
I think the evidence is pretty starkly that it does. I mean, you know, when study after study is done about the sociology of people that attend church versus the wider culture,
mm-hmm.
there's very, very little that ever shows up that distinguishes the practices and habits of Christian people from those that are not Christian. How we spend our time, what our addictions are, what we do with our money, how we prioritize our values, how we engage in response to people that live at the margins of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Almost nothing shows up as a common trait of the church. And as far as I can see in the New Testament, that is not at all how Jesus saw the people of God.
In Chapter 9, called The Way of Suffering, where does that enter into this whole business of God's call? You're suggesting that God calling us doesn't mean we're immune to suffering.
Right. We're definitely not immune. And in fact, sometimes, maybe even often, our call will lead us into suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the Bible ever teaches that we should seek suffering or that suffering is itself a goal of God or a purpose of God. But if we really believe in a God who identifies with the world and says to us that if we truly follow him, we too will take up our cross and do so, it means that we will enter into the heart of a God who suffers with a needy world. And I think in that context, that's a really different vision than a vision of the church as a church that's called to a gospel where God fulfills all of our dreams and gives us every hope and desire that we might want in order to make us happy. That's not my picture of how I understand what Jesus is teaching or about how the New Testament writers actually describe what the experience of being a follower of Jesus is really about.
Explain to our listeners about the format of the book. At the end of each chapter, you have something called practice.
Yeah, I think the thing that's interesting about that word practice is that I think being a follower of Jesus literally meant, in the case of the 12 disciples, learning to practice being with him and to practice imitating him. Part of why he sends them out on the missions that he does and why they debrief it and why he calls them on and why he wants to be with them, and all of that is a very, very significant part of what it is that Jesus does to train people. So it's not just that we're called to believe it. So it's not just a set of questions about think about these things and consider whether or not you affirm them, but instead, yes, do that, by all means do that, and then also ask, and how will I actually practice this? It's interesting that as more and more is discovered about the brain, one of the really interesting things is that that actual practice shapes our thinking more than we believe. It's not just that our thinking shapes our practice, but our practice shapes our thinking. And if our practice isn't what our practice should be, it will not affect the way that we actually think about God, ourselves, our neighbor, etc. We have to actually, literally, as Jesus says at the end of Matthew 7, we have to do the truth and not just affirm it. It's the difference between sand and rock.
Pastor, where can we get a copy of your book?
It's available through University Press. You can get it there. You can get it online at Amazon.com. And it's available in a number of bookstores. But if you just go to Amazon, you'll probably find it the easiest way, or in your local independent bookstore.
Mark Labberton is the author of the book called The Crisis and Promise of Following Jesus Today. Thank you, Mark, for being on LifeQuest.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. My name is Dwight Lainhoff.